Imagine it is like 3 o'clock in the morning.
Okay.
You're lying in bed, you're absolutely exhausted, but your heart is just racing.
Yeah, that's the worst.
Right. Your blood pressure is elevated and your brain's threat detection center is just, well, it's firing on all cylinders. Like you're being stalked by a predator in the dark.
But there is no predator.
Exactly. The room is completely silent. The
Oh.
only issue is that the ambient temperature in your bedroom is 26 degrees Celsius and it hasn't dropped for 3 days.
Right.
So today we are looking at a scenario that is playing out in literally millions of bedrooms around the world. And it completely, I mean, it just shatters the way we have traditionally talked about climate change.
It really does. I mean, the old diagnostic framework for the climate crisis is, well, it's basically obsolete at this point.
Yeah.
For decades, the entire conversation was framed around, geographical and temporal distance.
Like things happening far away or way in the future.
Exactly. The metrics were parts per million of carbon dioxide in the upper atmosphere, or the slow retreat of glaciers in the Arctic, or sea level rise projected for the year 2100.
Right, the year 2100, always 2100.
Always. It was this abstract atmospheric problem for, future generations. But what the current research demonstrates is that the crisis has, well, it's breached the atmosphere. It has entered the human nervous system.
And that is the exact mission of this deep dive. We are pulling from an incredibly comprehensive dossier today, spanning hard climate science, neurobiology, urban planning, and even some philosophical frameworks like the sources mentioned, Fractal the Trilogy and the Oracle 2.0.
Yeah, some really heavy, fascinating texts in there.
Really fascinating. And we are trying to extract the ultimate blueprint for navigating a warming world.
Right.
Because we have to move past the paralysis of eco-anxiety,
Right.
and we really have to abandon this dangerous illusion that some magical technological silver bullet is just going to drop from the sky and save us.
Yeah, the tech savior complex is a trap.
It is. We're looking for genuine, holistic resilience here. And the core philosophy running through all these sources is a massive paradigm shift. It argues that the external collapse of stable weather patterns is actively mirroring an internal fracture in human consciousness.
Right, this idea that we are not just standing on the earth, managing it like it's a
Yeah,
warehouse.
exactly. We are an active participating node of its ecosystem.
Yeah.
So, okay, let's unpack this. Because the most effective way I found to visualize this shift is to think about a fever.
Oh, that's a good analogy.
Yeah, when you get a severe viral fever, it is never just a number on a thermometer.
No, not at all.
That number is just the metric. The actual experience of the fever is entirely systemic. Your joints ache, you lose your
We
appetite.
get that terrible cognitive fog.
Exactly. Cognitive fog, maybe even delirium. Your sleep cycle is destroyed and your entire daily routine just fractures. Planetary warming is exactly that.
Right.
It's a systemic fever. And the Earth's fever is now intimately impacting the biological, the social, and, well, the psychological facets of our daily lives.
And treating this as a systemic fever requires us to change our initial point of investigation. Like before we can even begin to analyze how our municipal power grids or, say, our agricultural supply chains are failing, we must look inward.
Right.
We have to examine how the biological infrastructure of the human body fundamentally breaks down under sustained thermal stress. And the most insidious damage isn't happening during the peak heat of the afternoon sun.
Which is wildly counterintuitive, right? I mean, when people think of heat-related illness, the mental image is always, heat stroke on a blistering asphalt parking lot at noon.
Yeah,
Yeah.
exactly. And the midday sun is dangerous, obviously, but it is a visible, avoidable danger for most people. You go inside, you find shade. The most widespread physiological devastation actually occurs in the dark through a phenomenon that meteorologists classify as tropical nights.
Tropical nights.
Yeah. A tropical night occurs when the ambient temperature fails to drop below a threshold of 20 to 25 degrees Celsius.
Wow, okay.
And to understand why this is so destructive, we have to look at the mechanics of human sleep architecture. So, in order for the brain to initiate sleep, and more importantly, to maintain the stable architectural stages of sleep throughout the night, your core body temperature must drop by about 1 to 2 degrees.
Right, and the body achieves that drop by pushing warm blood away from the core out to the skin, right?
Exactly.
It relies on the cooler air in the bedroom to pull that heat away from the body.
Right. That process is called vasodilation. Your heart pumps that internal heat to your extremities so it can radiate into the environment. But if the ambient temperature of your bedroom is hovering at 26 degrees, that thermal gradient doesn't exist.
Oh, because the air is as warm as the skin.
Exactly. The heat cannot transfer, so your core temperature stays elevated. And the advanced polysomnography data in our dossier reveals that this thermal blockade utterly decimates the deepest, most restorative stages of sleep.
The sources specifically highlight the suppression of slow-wave sleep, which sleep scientists call the N3 stage, and REM sleep, or rapid eye movement.
Right.
And we are not just talking about waking up feeling a little groggy.
Oh, far from it, no. Slow-wave sleep is the mandatory maintenance cycle for human physiology.
Yeah.
It's when tissue repair happens, when brain metabolites are cleared out.
Yeah.
And crucially, it is the only time the cardiovascular system gets to rest.
Wow.
Yeah. When thermal stress deprives you of N3 sleep, your heart is forced to continuously pump blood to the skin all night in this desperate, failing attempt to cool the core.
So it's like you're running a marathon while you're lying in bed.
Basically, yeah. Yeah. And that lack of recovery spikes your arterial blood pressure the next day. It elevates the resting heart rate. Over multiple tropical nights, it drastically increases the statistical risk of acute cardiovascular events, including myocardial infarctions and strokes.
So the heart is just completely exhausted.
Right.
But then there is the suppression of REM sleep, which seems to attack the mind. Because REM is, you know, widely understood as the stage where the brain processes emotional stress and regulates mood.
Yeah.
If the body is actively suppressing REM sleep because the room is too hot, how does that actually manifest in a person's behavior the next morning?
Well, what's fascinating here is the sheer neurobiological cascade that follows REM deprivation.
Yeah.
During REM sleep, the brain actively recalibrates the prefrontal cortex, which is the region responsible for, you know, executive function, logic, impulse control.
Right, the adult in the room.
Exactly. And the prefrontal cortex acts as the regulatory brake on the amygdala.
The amygdala being the primitive emotional threat detection center.
Right. So when you lose REM sleep to thermal stress, you lose that regulatory brake. You experience profound cortical dysregulation.
Which explains the visceral scenario we started with. The brain perceives a threat that isn't there.
It's the biological unraveling of the body's innate capacity to process the minor traumas of daily existence. It leads to severe emotional reactivity, intense irritability, and a statistically measured increase in interpersonal aggression and violence during extended heat waves.
Wow.
The nervous system is essentially stripped of its shock absorbers.
So what does this all mean for the average person? Because it translates directly into the broader mental health crisis that was detailed in the research from the European heat waves of 2025 and 2026.
Yeah.
The sources outline how extreme heat acts as a biological catalyst for severe psychiatric outcomes. The research shows it triggers the HPA axis, the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis.
Right.
And that triggers a systemic stress response, flooding the body with cortisol. The downstream effects are massive.
Yeah.
Neuroinflammation, oxidative stress, and even a measurable disruption of the blood-brain barrier.
Yeah, that physiological strain fundamentally alters the production and uptake of neurotransmitters like serotonin and dopamine. Because of this, the vulnerability to heat is what epidemiologists call transdiagnostic.
Meaning it crosses all boundaries of mental health conditions.
Exactly. During those European heat waves, emergency psychiatric consultations just spiked across the board. The ambient heat exacerbated schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, severe depression, and substance use disorder simultaneously.
And there is this brutal, almost tragic feedback loop embedded in that transdiagnostic vulnerability. For a lot of these conditions, the standard of care involves pharmacological treatments, right? Like SSRIs, antipsychotics, lithium.
Yes.
But many of these psychiatric medications inherently impair the body's hypothalamus, which controls thermoregulation. So a neighbor taking an SSRI for depression might literally lose the ability to sweat efficiently.
Right.
So the medication they rely on makes them hypersusceptible to heat stroke, while the environmental heat simultaneously amplifies the psychiatric symptoms they are trying to manage.
It's an inescapable cycle.
It really is.
And that strict biological limitation isn't just isolated to psychiatric care either. The data on maternal health paints an incredibly stark picture of human limits. Yet the clinical data on maternal hypertensive disorders, or MHD, maps this vulnerability perfectly. Researchers plot these maternal health risks against something called the wet bulb globe temperature, or WBGT.
Right.
Unlike a standard thermometer, WBGT measures the true physiological heat load on the human body by combining ambient temperature, humidity, wind speed, and solar radiation.
And humidity is the critical variable there, right? Because if the air is saturated with moisture, human sweat cannot evaporate.
Exactly. If sweat doesn't evaporate, the body cannot cool itself, regardless of how much water you drink.
Right. And when you map maternal health against that specific wet bulb metric, a terrifying U-shaped curve emerges in the data.
Yeah, the burden of maternal hypertensive disorders hits its absolute lowest point when the wet bulb temperature is around 11.7 degrees Celsius. But as the temperature rises, the human body reaches a rigid physiological boundary. Once the WBG crosses 27 degrees Celsius, the risk curve rockets upward.
27 degrees? That doesn't even sound that hot until you realize it's wet bulb.
Right, wet bulb 27 is intensely stressful. At that threshold, pregnant women are placed in severe, immediate physiological peril. The cardiovascular strain of supporting fetal development, combined with the cardiovascular strain of thermal regulation, simply overwhelms the maternal system.
Okay, but look at how a lot of the modern world operates. The immediate cultural reaction to everything we just discussed is simply, well, I'll just stay inside and turn up the air conditioning.
Sure, yeah.
So why isn't that a valid long-term strategy? Are we just finding a mechanical band-aid to mask a profound biological vulnerability? Because it really seems like relying on an HVAC system ignores the fact that human adaptation has these rigid, non-negotiable biological limits.
The danger of that mechanical band-aid is scale.
Okay.
If the individual human body hits a physiological wall under extreme thermal stress, we have to look at what happens to the collective macro body of our society, you know, our infrastructure, when it hits that exact same wall. The air conditioning strategy relies on the assumption of infinite uninterrupted power. And the European heat waves of 2025 and 2026 served as a catastrophic systemic stress test that shattered that assumption entirely.
The mechanics of that 2026 emergency are staggering just to read about. In late May, meteorologists watch a massive omega block form over Western Europe.
Yeah, a textbook omega block.
And for those unfamiliar, an omega block is a highly disruptive atmospheric pattern where a high pressure system gets wedged between two low pressure systems. The jet stream buckles around it, forming the shape of the Greek letter omega.
Right.
And that high pressure dome becomes entirely stationary. It acts like a lid on a pot, trapping the air underneath. The sinking air compresses and heats up day after day. It pulled scorching air directly up from North Africa and locked it over the continent early in the season, meaning populations had zero time to biologically acclimatize.
And the statistical fallout from that was unprecedented. By June and July, the blocking pattern generated apocalyptic surface temperatures. Sicily recorded 46.5 degrees Celsius.
46.5.
Wow, parts of France exceeded 44 degrees. The provisional mortality data confirmed over 33,000 heat-related fatalities across Europe in the summer of 2026 alone.
33,000.
Yes. And furthermore, 60% of all hospital admissions originating from emergency departments were individuals aged 75 and older. It was a brutal exposure of how aging biology interacts with failing infrastructure.
Yeah.
But the catastrophe extended far beyond public health. It triggered a massive macroeconomic shock.
The economic hemorrhage is almost hard to conceptualize. Like, the Lancet countdown had already reported an estimated 640 billion hours of lost global labor back in 2024 due to heat exposure.
Right.
But in Europe, during that single 2026 event, the estimated damages hit 180 billion euros. It wasn't just healthcare expenditures. Agricultural yields collapsed. Outdoor labor, you know, construction, infrastructure maintenance, farming, it all had to be entirely suspended because the wet bulb temperatures exceeded the limits of human survival.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture, the most profound and ironic infrastructural failure occurred within the energy-water nexus.
Right.
Which directly addresses the strategy of relying on air conditioning. As hundreds of millions of people simultaneously maximized their cooling systems to survive, electricity demand surged exponentially. Italy saw a 28% spike in peak demand. Hungary experienced a 23% surge.
But the grid was buckling precisely when it was needed most because of how traditional power generation works, right?
Exactly. Traditional thermal power plants, whether they are nuclear, coal, or natural gas, function by boiling water to create steam, which turns turbines. But to cool that steam back into liquid and complete the cycle, they require immense continuous volumes of cold river water.
Right.
And the 2026 heat wave arrived alongside a continent-wide drought, rivers were evaporating, the volume of water dropped, and the temperature of the remaining water spiked.
Which is a huge problem for the plants.
Huge. If a power plant draws in warm water and discharges boiling water back into a shallow river, it will instantly trigger a mass extinction event for the entire local marine ecosystem.
Wow.
So France was forced to throttle 17 of its 18 nuclear reactors to avoid boiling its rivers.
Yeah.
Poland had to manually take coal plants offline because the Vistula River was entirely compromised.
The imagery from Budapest during that period feels like something out of a dystopian novel. The Danube River, which is the lifeblood of that region, dropped to a record low of 21 centimeters within the city limits.
21 centimeters.
A 21-centimeter puddle of warm water. The riverbed was entirely exposed to the sun. Commercial and cruise traffic came to a dead halt. And in a desperate bid to keep the PAX nuclear power plant functional, authorities had to engineer an emergency dam.
Yeah.
They dumped 145,000 cubic meters of rock directly into the Danube purely to slow the current and pool enough cooling water upstream for the reactors.
It's incredible. The thermal power plants that historically pumped the carbon emissions into the atmosphere, creating the crisis over decades, were physically incapacitated by the very atmospheric conditions they engineered.
Wow.
It was a perfect closed-loop irony.
But the European grid didn't experience a total continent-wide blackout. The intervention came from a completely different sector of the energy mix, didn't it?
It did. The catastrophic failure of centralized thermal power was offset by decentralized renewable infrastructure. Aided by the totally clear skies associated with the Omega Block, the European Union generated a record 45 terawatt hours of solar electricity in June 2025.
45 terawatt hours?
Yes. Solar generation actually overtook coal in the European energy mix for the first time in history. And the vital mechanism here is peak alignment.
Peak alignment.
Right. The absolute maximum generation of solar power perfectly mirrors the peak daytime demand for air conditioning.
Hmm.
Coupled with utility-scale battery storage, such as the 14 gigawatts operating in Germany, the grid was able to time shift that excess daytime solar power to cover the evening demand when the sun went down.
Okay, but let's pause here. Look at Germany's solar success, or the 45 terawatt hours across the EU. That is a phenomenal engineering achievement.
It is.
So why can't we just say technology solved the problem? Why isn't a massive decentralized solar grid combined with high-efficiency HVAC systems enough to save these cities? If we have clean energy powering our cooling, haven't we adapted?
Well, that perspective completely ignores the physical reality of the spaces we inhabit. You cannot generate your way out of fundamentally broken spatial design.
How so?
Even if a solar panel is powering the air conditioner, that air conditioner is just pumping heat out of a sealed box and dumping it directly into a densely packed urban environment that is already baking.
Oh, right. The exhaust heat.
Exactly. The highest mortality rates and the most severe localized grid strains were hyper-concentrated in dense urban centers. If the vast majority of humanity is going to live in cities, we have to analyze how the geometry and materials of those cities actively weaponize the climate.
That brings us to the mechanics of the urban heat island effect, or UHI. A city is essentially a massive localized battery for thermal energy. The infrastructure, you know, asphalt roads, concrete facades, dense geometric canyons of buildings, it all absorbs shortwave solar radiation throughout the entire day.
Right.
Then, as the sun sets, those materials slowly radiate that stored energy back out as sensible heat. Budapest was the primary case study in the dossier for this phenomenon. The inner city districts were recording ambient temperatures 6 to 8 degrees Celsius hotter than the surrounding green belts.
6 to 8 degrees is a massive difference.
It's huge. Satellite thermography during the heat waves captured surface temperatures on heavy commercial infrastructure exceeding 50 degrees Celsius.
50 degrees. Yeah, and to combat the urban heat island effect, urban planners have had to abandon the standard thermometer. Knowing the ambient air temperature is no longer sufficient to design a safe city block, planners now rely on advanced bioclimatic indices to calculate how the human body actually metabolizes the surrounding environment.
We mentioned WBGT earlier, but the research introduces other critical metrics. There is PE, the physiological equivalent temperature, which translates complex outdoor weather conditions into a standardized feels like indoor temperature for a typical human.
Right.
But the absolute gold standard for modern urban design is something called UTCI.
The Universal Thermal Climate Index. UTCI is a masterpiece of biometeorology.
Right.
It utilizes a highly advanced multi-node thermoregulatory model of the human body.
Ooh, well.
It doesn't just look at the air. It calculates the exact physiological stress a person experiences by factoring in ambient temperature, humidity, wind velocity, and a critical variable known as mean radiant temperature, or MRT.
MRT.
Yes. MRT measures the total heat radiating onto a human body from all surrounding surfaces.
So the asphalt beneath your feet.
Yes.
The brick wall next to you. The glass skyscraper reflecting the sun.
All of it. And manipulating that radiant temperature is where urban adaptation becomes incredibly treacherous.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Because if you ask a layperson how to cool down a hot concrete city, the intuitive answer is just to paint everything white. High albedo materials. White roofs. Reflective pavements.
Right, it seems logical.
The physics makes sense. Reflective surfaces bounce the shortwave solar radiation back up into the atmosphere before the concrete can absorb it. The buildings stay cool, the AC demand drops, the grid stabilizes. It sounds like a perfect solution.
It is a perfect solution for the building's internal energy efficiency, but it creates a devastating localized hazard known as a severe MRT penalty.
MRT penalty.
Yes. If you replace dark asphalt with highly reflective white pavement, the pavement itself remains cool. But the shortwave radiation doesn't just disappear. It reflects off the ground and bounces directly into the physical bodies of the pedestrians walking on that street. You are actively increasing the mean radiant temperature hitting the human being. The UTCI, the actual physiological stress level, skyrockets.
It's like a game of climatic whack-a-mole. Mm. You push the heat down inside the office building by installing a cool roof or reflective pavement, but that exact same heat pops up and literally bakes the outdoor worker, the pedestrian, or the unhoused person on the sidewalk.
Exactly.
You solve an engineering problem, and you accidentally weaponize the street level against the most vulnerable populations.
And that unintended weaponization of the street is exactly what forces urban planners to abandon single technology solutions. The architecture of climate resilience demands a methodology called synergistic layering.
Synergistic layering.
Right. You cannot just deploy a technology. You have to engineer an ecosystem. If a municipality installs reflective pavements, they must simultaneously deploy a dense canopy of street trees. The biological canopy provides direct solar shading, neutralizing the radiant penalty before it hits the pavement.
Oh, that makes sense.
While simultaneously cooling the ambient air through evapotranspiration, which is essentially the trees sweating to cool the microclimate.
And then you add the technological layer on top.
Yeah.
You deploy rooftop photovoltaics, solar panels. The panels intercept the solar radiation, generating electricity for the grid, while passively casting shade on the roof beneath them, lowering the building's cooling demand without creating a radiant penalty for the street. It's a perfectly balanced ecosystem.
But transitioning our cities from concrete machines into living, balanced ecosystems, requires more than just new zoning laws. It requires a fundamental shift in how we perceive our environment. We have spent this entire time detailing the physical breakdown of human biology and urban infrastructure. But running an exact parallel to this physical collapse is a profound, pervasive psychological crisis. You cannot simply layer a city in street trees and expect the population to thrive if the collective psyche remains fundamentally fractured.
The psychological toll of this planetary shift is incredibly complex. For years, the dominant terminology in the media has been eco-anxiety. The research dossier defines eco-anxiety very specifically as a future-oriented fear. It's a state of chronic dread. It's the experience of reading a UN climate report, looking at the gigatons of historical carbon emissions, and feeling a pervasive, paralyzing worry about the habitability of the planet 10 or 50 years from now.
Eco-anxiety is dread for tomorrow. But there is a secondary, far more visceral psychological phenomenon detailed in the research, conceptualized by environmental philosopher Glenn Ulbricht. He coined the term solastalgia.
Solastalgia, it's an incredibly evocative word. It merges the Latin word solacium, meaning comfort, with the Greek root algos, meaning pain.
Exactly. Solastalgia is a present-oriented distress. Ulbricht defines it as the profound, uncanny sensation of feeling homesick while you are still standing in your own home.
Wow.
It occurs because your immediate, localized environment is degrading before your very eyes. It is the grief of a farmer watching ancestral topsoil turn to useless dust. It is the acute distress of a resident in Budapest looking down at the mighty Danube River and seeing a 21-centimeter puddle of warm water. The landscape of home has become unrecognizable.
A vital clarification made by the Climate Psychology Alliance within our sources is the issue of pathologization. Neither eco-anxiety nor solastalgia should be treated as clinical psychiatric disorders.
Right.
They are not chemical imbalances to be medicated away with a new prescription. They are completely rational, biologically appropriate responses to a genuine existential threat. The danger isn't the feeling itself. The danger is that the sheer incomprehensible scale of the crisis induces a state of learned helplessness.
When an individual mind attempts to process a global atmospheric crisis involving billions of tons of invisible gases, the nervous system freezes. To map a way out of that paralysis, the dossier utilizes the philosophical framework presented in the Oracle 2.0.
Right.
This text suggests that this global paralysis triggers an evolutionary inner war within the human psyche, unfolding in four distinct stages.
The first stage is denial. And this isn't necessarily political climate denial. It's a psychological defense mechanism.
Yes.
The ego refuses to look at the shadow. It attempts to maintain the illusion of absolute safety. The mindset is, you know, if I don't engage with the reality of the changing climate, it cannot harm me.
But when the reality of the heat wave finally shatters that denial, the psyche enters the second stage, panic. This is a frantic, dysregulated response to the sudden realization that the environment is out of our control. The mind is terrified by the unpredictability of the future.
That panic usually forces action, leading to the third stage, which is mechanical adaptation. This is the attempt to assert control by building higher seawalls, or cranking up the HVAC system, or painting the streets white without thinking about the radiant heat penalty. It's a desperate attempt to fortify the existing system without addressing the root cause or the holistic reality of the problem.
Which brings us to the final stage, what the Oracle 2.0 calls responsibility. This is a state of grounded psychological alignment. It is the deep realization that you cannot individually control the macrocosm of global atmospheric emissions, but you possess absolute agency over your microcosm.
Your household, your immediate community, your localized relationship with the environment.
Exactly.
But I have to challenge this philosophical framing. I mean, it is a beautiful poetic concept to say, embrace the grief, reach grounded alignment, and take responsibility. But how does a normal person actually manifest that when they are terrified about their skyrocketing electricity bill? How does a single parent practice grounded alignment when they are just frantically trying to keep their children hydrated during a 46-degree tropical night? How does this high-level philosophy actually hit the pavement?
This raises an important question, because philosophy without application is useless in an emergency. The bridge between that internal responsibility and physical survival is social cohesion. Sociological research consistently demonstrates that communities with robust, active social networks, you know, neighborhoods where people actually know each other, check on each other, and share resources, they exhibit significantly higher survival rates during extreme heat waves, regardless of their income bracket.
Wow. Regardless of income.
Yeah. The source text frames this beautifully. It says, grief over the climate is not a weakness. Grief is simply the echo of love searching for a place to land.
That's powerful.
When that grief is validated and shared within a community network, it ceases to be paralyzing. It transforms from isolated helplessness into collective, organized agency.
And that transformation from isolated panic to collective agency is the fundamental engine driving the ethics of adaptation. For decades, the global climate policy space was locked in a rigid debate between two camps: mitigation versus adaptation.
Right.
Mitigation focuses on reducing carbon emissions to prevent further warming. Adaptation focuses on altering our cities, our agriculture, and our behaviors to survive the warming that is already locked in. And for a long time, the environmental movement was deeply terrified of the adaptation trap.
The fear of the adaptation trap was entirely valid, honestly. The concern was that if society heavily invested in adaptation, you know, building massive seawalls, engineering better air conditioning, genetically modifying crops, it would provide the fossil fuel industry with a permanent alibi to continue extraction.
Right.
The narrative would become, well, we don't need to regulate emissions. We can simply engineer our way out of the consequences.
But the scientific and ethical consensus across our sources is that the debate is over. Both strategies are absolutely mandatory.
Absolutely.
Pursuing adaptation without mitigation is a mathematical failure. Eventually, the thermodynamic energy trapped in the system will exceed the physical limits of any seawall or cooling center.
Exactly.
But pursuing mitigation without adaptation is a catastrophic humanitarian failure, because the atmospheric heat is already here and vulnerable populations are suffering the consequences today.
Furthermore, if we do not adapt with a strict ethical framework, we will rapidly engineer a dystopia that the sources define as eco-apartheid.
Eco-apartheid. It happens when climate resilience is fully commodified. Survival becomes a luxury good. The affluent can afford to retrofit their homes with high-efficiency HVAC systems, install solar microgrids, and migrate to elevated neighborhoods with mature irrigated tree canopies. They achieve biological safety.
While marginalized communities, who often possess the lowest carbon footprints, are trapped in the densest, most concrete-heavy urban heat islands, working exposed outdoor jobs, bearing the absolute brunt of the mortality statistics.
To dismantle the threat of eco-apartheid, adaptation measures must be codified as a public right rather than a private commodity. The urban planning research highlights governance tools like community land trusts, or CLTs.
Right.
These trusts are a vital mechanism to prevent a phenomenon known as climate gentrification.
Yeah, climate gentrification is a massive issue.
Right, because if a municipality targets a low-income, high-heat neighborhood and successfully layers in green infrastructure, planting a massive urban canopy, installing permeable pavements, building flood defenses, the environment becomes infinitely safer.
But instantly, the property values skyrocket. Rents double.
Exactly. And the original vulnerable residents who desperately needed that biological protection are economically displaced, pushed out into less resilient areas. Community land trusts decouple the ownership of the land from the housing market, ensuring that when the neighborhood is ecologically upgraded, the community gets to stay.
So synthesizing all of this, the neurobiology of sleep, the failing power grids, the urban trade-offs, and the inner psychological war, the Source Dossier provides a cohesive framework for action. It's called the Climate Resilience Compass, functioning as a practical toolkit for exactly this kind of holistic adaptation.
Right. So let's go through the seven pillars.
The groundwork begins with the physical reality, protecting the human body. This means acknowledging those rigid physiological limits, hydrating effectively, and pushing local municipalities to implement heat health action plans that are triggered by the WBGT index, not just standard temperature.
But securing physical safety instantly requires the second element, building local community networks. Isolation during a tropical night is a lethal vulnerability. Resilience looks like mutual aid groups, organized wellness checks for the elderly, and shared accessible cooling spaces.
And as those communities organize, they can drive the third element, which is adapting our homes and cities. We transition away from energy-intensive active cooling and demand intelligent passive design. Cool roofs properly layered with urban canopies to manage the radiant heat penalty.
And by engaging in that community-level action, we naturally achieve the fourth goal, which is transforming eco-anxiety into actionable purpose. You stop treating the grief as a disease and channel it into municipal planning or local ecosystem restoration, which segues perfectly into this principle. And this is a profound paradigm shift, reducing consumption without guilt.
This one is huge. For years, the environmental movement weaponized guilt around the individual carbon footprint, which ultimately just drains human energy. The Compass framework repositions minimalism not as a punitive restriction, but as profound liberation. Consuming less ceases to be a sacrifice. It becomes a deliberate, joyful step toward finding wealth and community connection and presence, rather than in the endless extraction of resources.
That liberation frees up the resources required for the sixth principle, supporting vulnerable populations first. Climate justice dictates that public resources for adaptation must be directed toward the unhoused, the elderly, and marginalized neighborhoods long before they are used to subsidize upgrades in affluent areas.
And all of these actions culminate in the seventh overarching goal, rebuilding a sacred relationship with nature. We have to remember that we are biological constituents of the Earth's ecosystem, not its managers.
Which brings us back to the core philosophical thesis presented in Fractal the Trilogy.
Yes. If we simply upgrade our infrastructure, if we build indestructible power grids and hyper-efficient air conditioners, but we retain the exact same domination-driven extractive consciousness that precipitated the crisis, we have not solved the root problem. We have merely engineered a more resilient cage.
A more resilient cage.
Hmm.
Wow.
Technology must cease to be a tool of brute force extraction. It must become a sacred extension of the human spirit, utilizing a solar panel to harvest ambient energy without poisoning the sky, perfectly aligning our needs with the thermodynamic flows of the planet.
So what does this all mean for us? The physical manifestations of the climate crisis, the failing power grids, the unlivable tropical nights, the devastating loss of agricultural yields, they are ultimately the physical manifestation of our psychological illusion of separation.
Right.
We convinced ourselves we were separate from the biosphere. We aren't. The planet is currently putting human civilization through the grueling labor pains of a necessary transition. We are being forced by the limits of our own biology to move from a paradigm of survival through control to a paradigm of thriving through ecological alignment.
We are tasked with learning how to perfectly balance the complex variables of the Universal Thermal Climate Index on our physical city streets while simultaneously navigating and balancing the inner psychological war in our minds. Outer resilience and inner evolution are intrinsically linked.
And as we close this deep dive, I want to leave you, the listener, with a final provocative thought to explore on your own. We have spent this time discussing how human consciousness is an active participating node of the Earth's biological ecosystem. But we are simultaneously living through an unprecedented explosion in artificial intelligence. We are increasingly merging our daily reality with digital synthetic environments.
Right.
So the question is, as AI becomes ubiquitous, will it further sever our sacred relationship with nature? Will it trap us in a purely synthetic digital world where we become completely detached from the biological limits of our own physical bodies?
Or conversely, could artificial intelligence become the ultimate analytical bridge?
Exactly. Could it be the hyper-intelligent tool we need to perfectly calculate those impossibly complex microclimatic trade-offs, balancing cool pavements, street trees, energy grids, and water systems block by block, effectively using our most advanced technology to weave human infrastructure seamlessly back into the natural rhythms of the biosphere?
It is the ultimate crossroads for our species. Will our ultimate technological creation deepen the dangerous illusion of separation? Or will it finally grant us the capacity to map the intricate ecological connections we have been blind to for centuries?
Because right now, the planet has a systemic fever, and you are a living cell inside that body. The X-ray machine of the past won't save us this time, but recognizing that we are an active, inseparable part of the very system we are trying to heal, well, that just might be how the fever finally breaks.